忙来嘛，不要输来等你来，不要输来等你来，来嘛来嘛，哎来哎来哎来哎，不要输来等你来，忙起来。
Hello, this is New Books in Southeast Asian Studies, coming to you via iTunes and the web. I'm Nick Cheeseman, a member of the Institute for Advanced Study, Princeton. Today's guest is Pamela McAlwey, an associate professor in human ecology at Rutgers University, who is joining us to discuss Forests Are Gold, Trees, People and Environmental Rule in Vietnam, published this year, 2016, by the University of Washington Press. Pam, it's lovely to have you on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've an impressive number of strings to your bow. You've studied political science, anthropology, forestry, and environmental science. You've worked in government agencies and as a consultant on international projects as well as in academia. So what brought you through your general research interests to write a book on the political ecology of Vietnam?
Well, I've always been interested in environmental issues. That's always been my passion ever since I was young. And so I journeyed through various academic pathways, but always with an eye towards thinking about environmental policy. So as you mentioned, for a while, I was a political scientist as an undergraduate. That led me to do some policy work for the federal government for a very short while. But I was always a little bit dissatisfied with that work because I felt like I wanted to dig deeper into why policies often didn't work. And I felt like the work that I was doing at the time, and this was the Clinton White House, the first year that they were trying to formulate a number of policies on carbon taxes and so forth, and nothing was going anywhere. And so I really felt like maybe I should be in academia and get to dig a little bit deeper into issues rather than bouncing from one policy to the next. And so that's what I did. I went back to school and then got master's and PhD degrees in forestry. And when I was doing my PhD in forestry at Yale, I added a second discipline of anthropology because I always felt like you can't talk about forests and forest policy without dealing with people. So all of those different trajectories have all come together around this idea that environmental policy ultimately has to be about people and their decisions. And so the various pathways that I've taken have led me to write this book about environmental policy in Vietnam. And the Vietnam setting is actually very serendipitous. I didn't have a background in Vietnam until I went to do my PhD at Yale, and I was just trying to find a field site where I thought things were interesting and intriguing, and I had an advisor who was interested in Asia and went to Vietnam one summer, and that was that. I decided I'd found my field site.
You describe one of the goals in writing the book, consistent with your disciplinary backgrounds, to bring the concepts of nature and culture back together. What do you mean by that, and how do you realize it's in the book?
Well, this is a big issue that a lot of people are grappling with, this idea that we call something an environmental policy, and it's put kind of off to the side in this box. That's an environmental policy. And then over here in this other box, those are social policies. And that division of treating the environment as something separate from humans that needs to put in its own disciplinary school, for example, I'm in a school of environmental and biological sciences, but I've always wondered, you know, why do we separate that out? Why is that something different than, say, social sciences or natural sciences? So it's always been difficult for me to understand why we think of environmental policy as this other thing, rather than thinking of as this holistic setting that encompasses everything that we have to deal with, the air we breathe, the places we live, the way we make our livings and so forth. And so there are a lot of people in anthropology, in geography, in allied disciplines right now, particularly interested in this idea of why do we treat nature and culture as these separate concepts? And there have been a lot of folks who have been theorizing about this for a while. Bruno Latour probably one of the best known. But for my setting in Vietnam, I really wanted to think about a way of writing a sort of environmental history of Vietnam that tried to give equal attention to nature and to culture, and to try not to treat them as these two separate realms, but rather think of nature as being shaped by culture and vice versa, culture as being shaped by nature, and that those two things were inexplicably tied together, and you couldn't separate them out if you really looked at how deeply they were entwined.
Digging a little bit deeper, you also identify a couple of puzzling observations that led you into the specific research that you undertook that culminated in the book. One, that reforestation and deforestation appeared to occur synchronously in Vietnam, and two, that afforestation policies were themselves apparently not aimed at the kinds of goals that environmentalists had in mind. This second point, perhaps going to what you're saying about the need to attend to culture, to political, social, and economic objectives. Could you say something about these puzzling observations and how they took you into the work that culminated in the book?
Absolutely. I mean, the thing that really struck me when I first started working in Vietnam was the fact that there was a massive push by the government to either reforest, that is to put forest in places that had previously had forest before, or to afforest, that is put forest in places where there had not been forests in recent memory. And this project for reforestation and afforestation was one of the largest development projects in Vietnam at the time I was doing my fieldwork, in terms of the total amount of funding. That essentially, all told, this 12-year project for reforestation received about $1 billion, which was an enormous amount of money for a small country like Vietnam. And I was really intrigued by why this was such a high priority, how it was playing out on the ground. And one of the justifications for this reforestation policy was that Vietnam ought to have forest cover equivalent to what it had been at the end of the colonial era, which was the 1940s, essentially. And I found this incredibly curious. Like, why was that the date that we had to somehow magically go back to? You know, why not before the colonial era? Why not some other point in time? And so there were all these interesting social or historical reasons for this reforestation project that nobody seemed to be talking about. And it was particularly interesting to me as well when the reforestation project came to a close in 2010, many people said, well, Vietnam has made this forest transition. And that's a term that people use to talk about the fact that most poorer countries, developing countries, tend to have higher deforestation rates while they're poor and developing. And then they reach a point of middle classness where they stop deforesting and they start afforesting again or reforesting again. So people were saying, well, it looks like Vietnam has made this transition. So they were deforesting for a while, and now we've had so much reforestation that they've turned the corner, and this is a sign that Vietnam is potentially becoming a middle-income country. But the more I dug into the figures on this, the more I found this very strange phenomenon, which is that the same time that Vietnam was doing this 12-year-long reforestation project, there was still massive deforestation going on in other places. So they were afforesting in some areas and deforesting in others. Now, it just so happened that the afforestation happened to be more expansive. And so it looked like the overall trend was towards afforestation. But nobody who had come up with this forest transition theory had ever speculated on the fact that there might be these two things, afforestation and deforestation, going on at the same time. And so it struck me as being a very odd puzzle, and that something I should look at more systematically. And so I did, and I had the good opportunity to be doing field work in 2001 and 2002 when the money from this national reforestation project came to the local area where I was working. And so I could really kind of follow the money and see where it was going and what species were being planted and who was planting these species, which was a fabulous opportunity because it gave me a much more concrete idea of why people were choosing to be involved in this reforestation program. And what I found was that the government justifications for the reforestation were on paper to regreen the countryside, to expand forest cover, to have biodiversity and watershed benefits. But there were a lot of hidden justifications underneath. And so the more I dug, the more I found some of these things. So they included everything from concerns about downstream water supplies for urban users, and that these upstream rural dwellers should basically sacrifice their land, turn them into forest to protect those water supplies for folks downstream. There was a lot of political justification for reforestation, local party bosses who owned sawmills or they owned companies that sold timber to coal mines where timber is used for pit props to construct the scaffolding within inside coal mines. So all sorts of reasons that never came out in public, that were never publicized, but they were definitely there. And one of the interesting reasons why local people got involved in reforestation was not because they cared about trees that much, but because they were able to get land tenure certificates for any land that they agreed to reforest. And so this was a time when Vietnam was shifting away from collectivized agriculture, from state-owned lands. And it was a time where people didn't really know, you know, who owned what piece of land and what authority they had over it. And so participating in reforestation seemed a very concrete way for people to get what they hoped would be more permanent land tenure certificates. And if they had to put some eucalyptus or some acacia trees on that land for 10 or 12 years, well, they would do it with the hopes that maybe later they could do something else with that land because they'd have that land tenure certificate in their hand. So this particular case study of the underlying reasons why people actually participated in a project that was cast as environmental led me to start questioning lots of environmental policies and to kind of come up with this theory that I call environmental rule, which is that oftentimes policies that are called environmental actually have much more social or economic or financial or bureaucratic or political reasons underneath. And so it's the job of academics to really dig down and find those true reasons. What are the real reasons why people are planting trees? What are the real reasons why local government officials want to fund these projects? And when you do that, you're able, I hope, to have a clearer picture of why some policies succeed and why some policies fail.
Let's break down environmental rule. You describe it as having five elements drawn from a couple of different bodies of theory. Can you unpack it for the listeners?
Absolutely. So in the book, I try to think about, you know, how do policies become cast as environmental, and how can we analyze them if there are these ulterior other reasons for policies? So I draw a lot on governmentality theory, coming from Foucault and other folks since then, since him, who have basically expounded upon his ideas. And one of the key things that Foucault always pointed to was that bounding a problem is a really important exercise, like setting the boundaries of what constitutes a problem. And that's very true in the environmental field. So trying to figure out why one thing is an environmental problem but something else isn't is something that I think has been fairly neglected in policy studies. Sometimes policies just sort of seem to take for granted that deforestation is a problem. But if we call deforestation by other names, land conversion or logging, then we might not see it necessarily as a problem. So figuring out what counts as a problem that needs to be addressed through policy is an important first step. So that's problematization, trying to figure out why something constitutes a problem. And then secondly, we have to generate some form of knowledge about this particular issue or problem. This often involves expertise. So foresters, people who have been professionally trained in forestry, are often the key individuals here. They're often using various mechanisms to calculate how many trees there are in a certain area, how big those trees are supposed to grow. And it's that knowledge production that often involves things like mapping forests or setting up boundary markers and so forth, basically constituting a space for which some sort of policy or some sort of intervention will be applied. So then the third step is understanding what an intervention in some environmental problem is going to be. And these can be widely varied. So in the book, for example, I talk about the reforestation projects. I talk about the creation of protected areas and the use of forest rangers to try to set aside forested areas that are not to be exploited by local populations. I talk about state ownership of forests during the socialist era, in which heavy logging was practiced. All of those are different forms of interventions, but they all have and share in common this idea that there's some sort of either state or community activity in forests that would constitute an intervention. And so then the fourth step comes directly from Foucault and studies of governmentality, and that is thinking about subjectivity. The people for whom this environmental policy is applied to them. How do they internalize it, accept it, go along with it, resist it? And what are the various tools that policy planners use to try to get people to go along with an environmental policy? So this could be everything from education to boundary enforcement, to arrests if you're in the wrong place, to confiscation of tools and forest products that you've collected. But all of these are aimed at trying to get people to follow the policy. So I want to understand that subjectivity that people themselves have about whether they're going to follow it or not. And then there's a fifth step that really comes less from governmentality and more from Bruno Latour and his work on actor network theory, because he talks a lot in that about the importance of networks for translating concepts and ideas and getting other people to be interested in those concepts and ideas. So, for example, if the policy intervention is to have reforestation, and if the underlying reasons are actually to have local party bosses have enough new trees that they can sell and make a big profit, but those guys are not going to be able to get widespread acceptance of this policy just on that basis alone. So they have to enroll other people into supporting their policy. And oftentimes it's those environmental justifications like reforestation being a biodiversity friendly or watershed strengthening policy. And that casting of things as environmental serves to then enroll people in a network so that they support that policy. So that's the fifth step, is really trying to spread your ideas, your policy, your intervention more widely through a network and get other people to sign on to it. And so by going through each of these steps, I'm hopeful that we can understand specific policies in more detail. And so I try to lay this out as a sort of methodology that other people could potentially use to look at other environmental cases far outside of Vietnam.
Great. Thanks for that summation. And of course, for anyone who does get a copy of the book, you can see a really nice laid out diagrammatic form of that, of your approach on page 27 of the introduction.
Yes.
Now, I'm sure that by this point, our listeners will have gathered that the book is both really theoretically sophisticated and it's also tremendously rich and multi-layered in its empirical contents. How, when and where did you collect the material that you drew upon to write the book?
Well, I first started working in Vietnam in 1996, and throughout grad school, I was essentially going back to Vietnam every year. And then I did 2.5 years worth of fieldwork from 1999 to 2001. And I had originally gone to look at the impacts of migration and the expansion of cash crops, particularly coffee, on forest areas in the Central Highlands of Vietnam. And so I was there in the Central Highlands for about 6 months and had collected some data and then was sort of unceremoniously pushed out by the local authorities. And I didn't know it at the time, but there was a lot of ethnic unrest that was about to erupt. And indeed, some big protests later erupted in 2001 and 2002. So I was gone by that time because I decided to choose another field site. And I ended up on the north central coast of Vietnam, about 300 kilometers south of Hanoi, in this area known as Ha Tinh Province. And people who are historians of Southeast Asia or Vietnam will recognize that province as being historically important because it was the site of massive protests against the French colonial authorities in 1930. This protest movement was known as the Nghệ Tĩnh Soviets. And it's really that movement which gives birth to the Indochinese Communist Party and its future leader, Ho Chi Minh. So it's a very historically important province in Vietnam for that reason. It was also very important and interesting at the time I was there because that particular province had seen the discovery of several new species of mammal in the 1990s, just right before I started doing my field work. And there was a flurry of activity in the province to try to potentially protect these animals by expanding existing protected areas and putting in new protected areas. So it was a great opportunity to see new policies being instituted for forests. And so I ended up doing field work in Ha Tinh for about a year and then left in end of 2001. And since 2001, I have had another sort of series of projects, including some work from 2004 to 2005, where I was back in Vietnam for another year and a half. Working on a variety of projects, particularly related to Sweden agriculture, working in some more mountainous areas of Vietnam and with some ethnic minority communities on why their Sweden agriculture, sometimes called shifting agriculture, the practice of doing agriculture within forested areas, why that practice was so discouraged in terms of policy from various successive state governments. So I did a lot of work in 2004 and 2005 on that. And then starting in 2008, I did a number of policy interviews with some very high-level people. I was very fortunate to get some folks at the National Assembly, the retired head of the Forest Protection Department for the entire country, a lot of people who worked for protected areas, to speak with me very frankly about why environmental policy so often failed in Vietnam. And then since 2011, I have been working in a new part of Vietnam, back in the Central Highlands, but in the province of Lâm Đồng, which is where the city of Da Lat is located, which some listeners may know. And this new project since 2011 has been looking at policies that have been instituted in the last few years to use the concept of ecosystem services As a organizing principle to protect forests and to use payments for these ecosystem services, payments that are made directly to people living in forested areas to try to get them to change their forest use practices. So over that span of essentially 20 years, I had a chance to look at lots of different types of policies in different areas of Vietnam, a mix of really intense ethnographic participant observation fieldwork during my dissertation, all the way up to these interviews with policymakers later on. And so I put all of that in the book. It's not a book just about, one location and one area of Vietnam. It's really about multiple sites and the interesting parallels that we see through different periods of history with regard to the types of policies that are directed at forests and environmental management.
Well, let's go to history and those different types of practices now. And the five enumerated chapters move across, how I read it, correct me if I'm wrong, four eras of environmental rule in Vietnam, or perhaps four regime types, the French colonial period, the post-colonial state socialist era up to 1986, thereafter, the period of socialist renovation, a euphemism for the turn back towards the marketplace, and subsequently post-renovation, the present era marked by new types of neoliberal calculation, intervention, and subjectivities. Each of the chapters is packed with fascinating material and insightful interpretations. It's supplemented by detailed maps, photographs, tabulated data, all of which has obviously involved a huge amount of work on your part, as some of which is manifest just from listening to your last response. As much as I'd like to dwell on each of the chapters at length, I think in the interests of time, it'd be great if you could just lead us fairly briskly and skillfully through the stages of environmental rule from the 19th century to the 1990s and tie together what you see as some of the major threads that run across these periods. And thereafter, we'll settle down and talk about Bald Hills and a few other things.
Yeah, that sounds great. So essentially what I try to do in the five main chapters is to think about how environmental rule has played out, as you point out, in these different historical eras. And so I start with the French colonial era, because I think that's really the first time that we see serious state-directed intervention in forests. I did some work with some pre-colonial materials, and there just wasn't that much direct intervention in forest management by the emperor and his bureaucrats. And so it was really first under French colonialism, so this is essentially the 1880s onward, that we start to see a really directed effort to establish forests as a problematic that need to be solved. And so for each of the chapters, I do those five steps of analyzing environmental rule that I just mentioned. So I try to talk about how was the problem identified and how have these problems around forests differed through different eras. So for the French colonial era, the problem that was identified for forests was that quote unquote native practices were contributing to the degradation of forests. But what this really meant in practice was that French colonial authorities felt that local wood use was wasteful and that it should be colonial authorities that were able to use high valued good woods that they could then export and or make some earnings off of. So the colonial enterprise in Vietnam was basically enacted on the cheap. Colonial authorities had to kind of fund their own activities. They weren't getting a lot of money from the metropole. So the forestry department that was set up essentially had to fund itself. And so they wanted to be able to institute reserves where they could log forests and make money off of them. And they essentially wanted to import the same model of forestry that they used in temperate France. And that is a model where you essentially have spatially delimited forest reserves. You cut a little bit of forest each year. You rotate around and you hope in 30 or 40 years you come back to the place that you started and you've got a tree that's grown back up and is ready to be cut again. That model of forestry works in temperate areas where you have one or two species like oak. It works horribly in the tropics where you have hundreds of species in just 1 or 2 hectares of land. And what it essentially ends up doing is wiping out all of the major important hardwood species and letting a lot of kind of scrubby softwood species grow up in its stead. And so French colonial authorities were constantly battling with the fact that their intervention didn't work, but yet they kept trying to apply it and coming up with new justifications for why their vision of forests should be supported. And so they would try to persuade other folks outside the forestry realm that they should support these logging reserves. I have a little section in the book where I talk about how the first French forest chief tried to get shipping companies to support his plan to reforest and protect large areas of land in northern Vietnam. And he made the argument that if those forests weren't protected, there would be siltation in the economically important harbor of Haiphong. And so therefore the shippers should support him. So essentially the French colonial era set up this pattern that was to be repeated over and over and over again of problematizing local use of forests as the thing that was contributing to their degradation, when in fact it was actually the intervention that the French were putting in place, this coupe forester, this forestry where you tried to move around and hope that the forest grew back up when you were done cutting. And so I really try to look in detail about the fact that these environmental justifications that native practices were degrading were really just the surface. And there were all these other reasons that French authorities were interested in managing forestry, a lot of them having to do with economics and having money for their budget. So then after the first chapter, which is exclusively on the French colonial era, I move on to chapter 2, which talks about the establishment of large-scale socialism in Vietnam after the conclusion of the Franco-Vietnam War, so after the end of French colonialism. So this is primarily in North Vietnam that I'm talking about, post-1945. And the new government, led by Ho Chi Minh, also found forests to be a potential problem for their new government, primarily because North Vietnam at the time was highly concentrated in terms of one small agricultural area, the Red River Delta, and then expansive mountainous forested highland areas. And so there was real concern on the part of the new authorities that they wouldn't be able to feed everyone on just the agricultural production in the Red River Delta. And so they needed to do quite a few other things to potentially solve this problem that involved moving people from the Red River Delta, having population disbursement, having them go up into the hills. It involved setting up major and massive state logging camps so that timber could be extracted for the new government and sold to have foreign exchange earnings to potentially buy food. There was also the concern that the new state needed to consolidate its border citizenry, many of whom were not ethnic Vietnamese. These are ethnic minorities like the Hmong, like the Thai, like the Tay, who live up in these mountainous areas, and there were concerns about their loyalties, to be quite honest. So all of these things came together in the guise of projects for forests in the guise of environmental projects, but they had all of these other social and political threads underlying them. So the big intervention that I talk about in chapter 2 was the establishment of these state-owned logging camps, which were extensive. They essentially nationalized and logged out massive areas of the highlands of Vietnam. And it's really kind of a hidden history. Not that many people know about these logging camps. I think everyone knows pretty well that there was agricultural collectivization during this time period, but there'd never been anything written about the highland areas and these forest camps, these state logging enterprises. So I interviewed people who had worked in them. I talked to folks, you know, they had to recollect back to these days, to the 50s and 60s and 70s, to get a sense of what it was like to live in these camps and to work as a laborer, essentially taking down trees and not doing a very good job of reforesting areas, unfortunately. So these state logging camps had massive environmental implications, which could have been predicted if there had been a better examination of these forest policies, if there'd been an understanding that the policies were actually not in place to protect the forest. They were in place to achieve these other social and political goals, like consolidating borders and so forth. So then I move on after that to chapter three, where I talk about the new opening up, the post-socialist era, so 1986 on. And the fact that this was an era where there was a new sense of having to figure out if you were a citizen in the post-socialist era, what was your role going to be? What was your relationship to the state? Who owned land now? Who was responsible providing social services and so forth? And so this was a time when there was a lot of uncertainty about who should be in charge of forests. And one of the new policies that the state government put in place was this shift away from logging and more towards environmental protection. So there was a big expansion of protected areas at this time. But it didn't work very well. And one of the reasons that didn't work is because the people that were put in charge of protecting these new reserved areas were often strongly accused of being folks who were actually logging on the side. There was a great deal of corruption among forest rangers at this time in this new market economy. And so there was a lot of clashes between local folks who had been using forests. They were now excluded from them because they were in protected areas. They saw rangers who were supposed to be protecting the forest not doing that. And so we had a lot of stories in the news about illegal loggers and their nefarious acts. And rangers, unfortunately, were often the very folks who were doing that illegal logging. So it was a time when there was a lot of upheaval. The policies put in place to make protected areas ended up in most cases being what we call paper parks. They were just kind of on paper, but there was not that much protection on the ground. So that sort of leads into what I talk about in chapter four, which is the reforestation projects that we've spoken about before. And a lot of these were aimed at trying to, on the surface, raise the amount of forested land cover back up to a time that had been previous in Vietnam's history. But as I mentioned, there were all these other social and economic reasons for afforestation as well. And one of the big problems that I saw when I was on the ground watching these projects roll out was the fact that poor people were often not included in afforestation projects because they were considered to not have sufficient labor or capital or enthusiasm. And so what actually ended up happening was the reforestation projects ended up increasing inequality of land holdings between rich and poor, which was not an objective at all, but it was an unintended outcome of that project. And so I conclude the book then in chapter five with looking at new, more market-oriented environmental policies. Some folks call these neoliberal policies. In this case, though, I would argue that there's still very heavy state involvement. They're not exclusively projects for privatization. And what these new approaches do is essentially try to treat the environment, treat ecosystem services as a product that can be marketed and paid for. So they have an element of neoliberal economy in them, but there's still a very heavy role for the state because the state sets up these payment exchanges. The state is involved in determining who pays money for these ecosystem services, who gets the money and so forth. And what I end up arguing in this chapter is that although on the surface, these payments for ecosystem services policies may seem like something new, something neoliberal or some sort of market approach, but they share in common very fundamental similarities with these previous eras of forest policy. And so I use the sort of five steps of environmental rule to look at these payments for environmental services approaches and show how they share a great deal in common in terms of how they problematize issues around forestry, how they apply an intervention, and then how they try to enroll other folks into supporting these policies, even though oftentimes underlying them are non-environmental reasons. And as I explained in Chapter 5, one of the big things that's been going on with payments for environmental services is actually a bureaucratic fight between two different ministries in Vietnam. So the Environment Ministry or the Forestry Ministry is trying to get money from the much richer and much more powerful Ministry of Industry and Trade, which is involved with hydropower selling and licensing. And so by asking people who use water to generate hydropower to then pay money to upstream forest protectors, it's essentially a transfer of money from a more wealthy ministry to a slightly poorer ministry. So that's an underlying reason that's not environmental at all, but these policies for ecosystem services are often called environmental policies, and I argue that they're actually not that at all, and that they have a much more political element to them. So those are the sort of key case studies, the different eras that I go through in the book. And then in the end, I try to sum up by saying that, you know, even though we talk about these historical eras as being so politically different, from French colonialism to state socialism to this post-socialist era, it's really remarkable how similar policies for forests have been throughout all those eras. Despite the political differences between them, the fundamental approach, this thing that I'm calling environmental rule, essentially goes on through all those eras.
Right. And one of the themes which you've already pointed to clearly, but that struck me as a reader, is the relationship between the political and economic reasons and how they're presented sometimes in ecological terms. And this seems to go back a long way into the state socialist period. You talk about how the basic goal was really the creation of new citizens from forest work rather than the protection of forests themselves. But it's in the latter chapters that it becomes really remarkably pronounced and very interesting. And one aspect of the fourth chapter that I'd like to dwell on briefly, if possible, is this notion of classification of bare hills, because it's a particularly illuminating way, I think, of illustrating this point, that that there are these purportedly bare hills, inverted commas, and yet, as you point out so powerfully, in fact, of course, they're not bare, and the consequences of classing them as bare are sometimes perverse. So could you say something more about that aspect of the fourth chapter?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's been a concern, actually, going back to the French era, of much of Vietnam being bare, being wasteland, being these bare hills. And one of the things that language does is it basically creates a justification for reforestation, right? If you call something bare, you essentially are saying you potentially want it to be unbare. You want it to have trees on it. You want to have something on it. And what I do in the fourth chapter is show through statistics and through maps and so forth and through interviews with folks living around these bare hills, and also through doing some transect work of my own, where I actually went out with tape measures and I counted all the species that were on some of these bare hills. And all of those different types of evidence show very clearly that in most of these cases where land is being called bare, it absolutely has vegetative cover on it. And sometimes it's tree cover. It's crazy. So the idea of there being a bare hill is a political classification. It has nothing to do with the actual ecology on the ground. And what calling a piece of land a Bear Hill does politically is it sets up a justification for there to be this intervention, an afforestation project or placing a protected area or doing something with the land that is extra local in most cases. And so the justification for this massive reforestation project in the late 1990s and up to 2010 was targeted. It was called the 5 million hectare reforestation project, and it was targeted at 5 million hectares of land, of which the vast majority of those 5 million hectares were called these Bear Hills. But they were actually lands that people were using, that there was actually vegetation growing on. So in some cases, a Bear Hill might be someone's pasture. It might be their Swidden field. It might be a locally managed village common where women collect non-timber forest products like broom grasses or medicinal plants to both use and sell. That essentially there were a lot of seemingly invisible users of these Bear Hills. But what the classification then set in motion were these interventions, these reforestation projects, which then ended up alienating large swaths of these Bear Hills and transferring them to middle class and wealthier households. Because in order to participate in this reforestation project, you had to agree to take oftentimes mostly free seedlings. You didn't have to put out too much money. You would get these free seedlings, you would get some fertilizer, but you had to expend your own family's labor to clear the land and plant these trees. But in return, you would then get a land tenure certificate that said you were in charge of these trees, you had the right to sell them, and it entitled you to use that land for at least 20 to 50 years, depending on where you were. So many people, as I said, willingly alienated lands that had previously been either village managed or had belonged to poor people or might have been open access but was managed at least somewhat nominally by folks that were using it. And the big losers of this process were poor people who ended up not being able to get their place in line for the reforestation project money. And often women were also losers of this project as well. Because women were oftentimes the users of these not very visible forest products like broom grasses. Broom grasses, these are just very simple grasses that people use to make house brooms, and they don't sell for very much, right? People were making maybe a dollar or two every few days when they collected broom grasses. It didn't seem like it was a very important source of income. But it was very important for women who didn't have other sources of pocket money, for example. So women could go out, collect some broom grasses for a few days, a month, sell them, have an extra $5 or $10 in their pocket, which they could use to buy school supplies for their children or buy a bicycle for their child or pay school fees and so forth. So when women lost access to these small sums of money, it was really unfortunate because what ended up happening when these lands were turned into afforestation zones, they were often planted with acacias and eucalyptus, which are both exotic species from Australia. They are not species that women prefer for fuel wood. Both of them are considered very poor for fuel wood. And so women were not that interested in these new forest plantations. They would provide the labor if their household had this land. But the trees on that land were usually the husband's. So women lost access to their pocket money, and then men were in charge of these new species, which were often sold for either low-value timber for garden furniture, or they were sold for pulp for paper factories. So it was really an unfortunate process, and it was one that was entirely avoidable if people had ahead of time understood more clearly that these Bear Hills were neither bare nor were they abandoned and unused, that they were very much used. And a project that, for example, focused on natural regeneration, maybe letting the local species continue to thrive, maybe some targeted plantings of local species within those natural regeneration areas. That would have been a strategy that would have kept the availability of these other forest products like broom grasses. It wouldn't have led to this overdetermined focus on exotic species, which are not very high value. But that wasn't the policy choice that was made. And so I talk in this chapter about the fact that essentially problematizing that first step as there being an issue with Bear Hills set into motion these other steps of assuming there's no owners, assuming no one's using it, assuming it should be reforested, assuming it should be reforested with a very fast-growing species. And the end result was something that we probably all could have predicted, and was unfortunate for women and poor folks in particular, as I say.
Now, someone from abroad might come and look at these hills covered with eucalypts and acacias and maybe see an Australian expert walking around.
Yeah.
And conclude, perhaps see some signs with the World Food Program logo, and perhaps conclude with a rather dim view of globalization that this is just some kind of neoliberal imposition of an economic valuation approach. But you say that, in fact, it needs to be understood as a relational idea that has become incorporated into multiple agendas and thus internalized and indigenized.
Right.
How so, briefly, and with what implications before we close?
Well, there's been a big issue with plantations, particularly plantations of exotic species in other areas of the world, particularly Latin America. There have been a lot of protests, for example, against large-scale eucalyptus plantations in places like Brazil and Chile. And one of the reasons why those protests, well, there's multiple reasons for those protests. The trees themselves are, for example, often very environmentally unsound. They tend to be water hogs. They often tend to be very vulnerable to storms. They blow over very quickly. So when they're taken outside of the setting of Australia, they tend not to be as hardy and useful a species as they are in their homeland. And so that's been one argument against them. But another big argument in these other countries outside of Vietnam has been that these plantations are often owned by large corporations. Perhaps a paper factory itself will own these large scale, multiple hundred or thousand hectares of land, which are then planted with these trees. What's happened in Vietnam has not been that. So these plantations that have spread out are not large scale ones. They're household plantations. So we're talking about anywhere from 2 to maybe maximum, 5 or 10 hectares per household. And they're not owned by these corporations. The land is owned, at least nominally, with these land tenure certificates by individual households. So on one hand, we might look at that and say, great, that's an example of there continuing to be a strong role for smallholders and their continuing to hang on to this land, and they're not being kicked off in favor of corporations. That seems like a good thing. But that's looking at the issue from the lens of 2016 rather than the lens of the year 2000 when I first saw this project go in. And I saw the people who were poor not having access to these plantations. A lot of those poor people have since left. They have migrated to cities. They didn't have a chance to really make a living in these areas that have now been given over to forest plantations. How many of them there are like that, we'll never know. But that's what I mean about the plantations themselves have been not a neoliberal imposition from the West, but they've been locally taken up and incorporated in these villages. And people have done so willingly. And it may seem strange, like why would someone willingly appropriate a neighbor's land or a village common? Why would you do that? And I argue in the book that one of the reasons why it became easy to do that was the fact that this national reforestation program cast the afforestation project in terms of what I might call righteous citizenship, that good citizens were citizens that planted trees. And if you planted trees, you could accumulate benefits for your household, sure, but it was also accumulating benefits for the nation. And you would get these propaganda posters and these education campaigns and newspaper articles that all talked about how important and patriotic it is to plant trees. These were often connected back to Ho Chi Minh himself, who was known to have started a tree planting program in the 1960s. And so by casting it in these very nationalistic, citizen-oriented terms, I think it enabled a lot of people to kind of skate over the fact that they were stealing land from their neighbors. They were appropriating village commons. But it was because it was for this national good that they were able to do it with less fuss and protests that they might have encountered otherwise. So there weren't these protests that we see in Latin America against plantations. Those didn't happen in Vietnam because who would you protest against? It was your neighbor that was planting the acacia. It wasn't some faceless corporation that had come in. So it made the situation very complicated. But what I try to argue in the book is that by casting these afforestation projects in these environmental terms, it enabled people to claim land, which is something they wanted to do anyway at this time of uncertainty, but cast that claiming in terms of being a good citizen, not being a land grabber, but being a good citizen. And so that was a big part of the story. And so I use on the cover of the book, actually, a propaganda poster encouraging people to plant trees as an example of this sort of nationalistic rhetoric about using the environment, but actually having these underlying reasons why these programs were actually in place.
I'm so glad you've mentioned the cover illustration because it really does capture beautifully many of the features, the contents of the book, including in some small details that I'll leave listeners to look for themselves. It would also be remiss, I think, as you've mentioned him a number of times, not to note that Ho Chi Minh was, you attribute the title of the book to him. But again, listeners are going to have to take a look into the book and learn more about the specific way in which his reference to forests of gold has been used over subsequent periods. Pam, the book has just come out, and so it might be premature to ask, but what are you working on now and what can we look forward to from you next?
Well, I have some material from the time that I was collecting all this work on forestry about animals and biodiversity. So the creatures that live in forests, and they did not find a home in this book. And I'm hoping to be able to use some of that material in a new book that I'm working on, which is really about humans and animals in the Anthropocene in Vietnam and Southeast Asia. And what I'm trying to look at is how human-animal dynamics have changed over time. So it's going to be a bit of a historical trek, just like this book has been, and look at changing dynamics over time. So everything from the elephant trade that was very important in Southeast Asia several centuries ago up to the present day, where I'm looking at new techniques to try to potentially save or bring back some of the endangered species in the region. And so I've got a case study of the Siamese crocodile, which is functionally extinct in the wild in Vietnam, but is massively raised in captivity and used for selling crocodile skins to the European fashion industry. So it brings in globalization and neoliberal economics and lots of things as well into the story in the contemporary times as well. So that's one of the new projects. And then I'm continuing to work on ecosystem services as well. And I'm hopeful that I will potentially be able to do a comparative project on ecosystem services, particularly watershed and river services, looking at the Red River in Vietnam and potentially the Irrawaddy River in Burma, Myanmar. So that's a longer term project, not really off the ground yet, more conceptual at this point, but it's something that I think is potentially exciting that I hope to pursue.
Well, in the meantime, I look forward to reading about the Siamese crocodile and yeah, indeed, the comparative project sounds fascinating as well. Pam, Michael, it's been a pleasure to talk to you today about forests of gold, trees, people, and environmental rule in Vietnam. Congratulations on the book, and thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks so much, Nick, for having me. I really appreciate it.
And thanks to everybody for listening to this episode of New Books in Southeast Asian Studies. I look forward to having you with us next time. And until then, why not check out a copy of Pam's book, as well as all of the other great New Books Network channels, like the New Books in Environmental Studies channel, where this episode will be cross-posted. Hey, thank God she get the tender bow. Monkey!